From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Snout by Edward White Lucas. I was not so much conning the specimens in the zoological garden as idly basking in the agreeable morning sunshine and relishing at leisure the perfect weather. So I saw him the instant he turned the corner of the building. At first, I thought I recognized him, then I hesitated. At first he seemed to know me and to be just about to greet me. Then he saw past me into the cage. His eyes bulged, his mouth opened into a long egg-shaped oval, till you might almost have said that his jaw dropped. He made an inarticulate sound, partly a grunt, partly the ghost of a howl, and collapsed in a limp heap on the gravel. I had not seen a human being since I passed the gate, some distance away. No one came when I called, so I dragged him to the grass by a bench, untied his faded, shiny cravat, took off his frayed collar and unbuttoned his soiled neckband. Then I peeled his coat off him, rolled it up, and put it under his knees as he lay on his back. I tried to find some water, but could see none, so I sat down on the bench near him. There he lay, his legs and body on the grass, his head in the dry gutter, his arms on the pebbles on the path. I was sure I knew him, but I could not recall when or where we had encountered each other before. Presently, he answered to my rough and ready treatment and opened his eyes, blinking at me heavily. He drew up his arms to his shoulders and sighed. "Queer," he muttered. "I come here because of you and I meet you." Still, I could not remember him, and he had revived enough to read my face. He sat up. "Don't try to stand up," I warned him. He did not need the admonition, but clung to the end of the bench, his head bowed waggingly over his arms. "Don't you remember?" he asked thickly. "You said I had a pretty good smattering of an education on everything except natural history and ancient history. I'm hoping for a job in a few days, and I thought I'd put in the time and keep out of mischief brushing up. So I started out on natural history first, and..." He broke off and glared up at me. I remembered him now. I should have recognized him the moment I saw him, for he was daily in my mind. But his luxuriant hair, his tanned skin, and above all his changed expression, a sort of look of acquired cosmopolitanism, had baffled me. "Natural history," he repeated in a hoarse whisper. His fingers digging in the slats of the bench, he wrenched himself round to face the cage. "Hell," he screamed, "there it is yet." He held on by the end iron arm of the bench, shaking, almost sobbing. "What's wrong with you?" I queried. "What do you think you see in that cage?" "Do you see anything in that cage?" he demanded in reply. "Certainly," I told him. "Then for God's sake," he pleaded, "what do you see?" I told him briefly. "Good Lord," he ejaculated. "Are we both crazy?" "Nothing crazy about either of us," I assured him. "What we see in the cage is what is in the cage." "Is there such a critter as that, honest?" he pressed me. I gave him a pretty full account of the animal, its habits and relationships. "Well," he said weakly, "I suppose you're telling the truth. If there is such a critter, let's get where I can't see it." I helped him to his feet and assisted him to a bench altogether out of sight of that building. He put on his collar and knotted his cravat. While I had held it, I had noticed that, though its greasy condition, it should plainly have been a very expensive cravat. His clothes, I remarked, were seedy, but had been of the very best when new. "Let's find a drinking fountain," he suggested. "I can walk." We found one not far away, and at no great distance from it, a shaded bench, facing an agreeable view. I offered him a cigarette, and we smoked. I meant to let him do most of the talking. "Do you know," he began presently, "things you said to me run in my head more than anything anybody ever said to me. I suppose it's because you're sort of a philosopher and student of human nature, and what you say is true. For instance, you said that criminals would get off clear 3 times out of 4 if they just kept their mouths shut, but they have to confide in someone, even against all reason. That's just the way with me now." "You aren't a criminal," I interrupted him. "You lost your temper and made a fool of yourself just once. If you'd been a criminal and had done what you did, you'd have likely enough got off, because you've calculated how to do it. As it was, you put yourself in a position where everything was against you, and you had no chance. We were all sorry for you." "You most of all," he amplified. "You treated me bully." "But we were all sorry for you," I repeated, "and all the jury too, and the judge. You're no criminal." "How do you know," he demanded defiantly, "what I have done since I got out?" "You've grown a pretty good head of hair," I commented. "I've had time," he said. "I've been all over the world and blown in $10,000. "And never seen," I began. He interrupted me at the third word. "Don't say it," he shuddered. "I never had nor heard of one, but I wasn't after caged animals while I had any money left. I didn't remember your advice and your other talk till I was broke. Now it's just as you said. I've just got to tell you. That's the criminal in me, I suppose." "You're no criminal," I repeated soothingly. "Hell," he snarled, "a year in the pen makes a man a criminal, if he never was before." "Not necessarily," I encouraged him. "It's pretty sure, too," he sighed. "They treated me mighty well and put me in bookkeeping, and I got my full conduct allowance. But I met professionals, and they never forget a man. Now, it don't make any difference what I did when I got out, nor what I tried to do, nor how I met Riven, nor how he put Thwaite after me. No, nor how Thwaite got hold of me, nor what he said to me, nor anything, right up to the very night till after we had started." He looked at me in the eye. His attitude became alert. I could see him warming to his narrative. In fact, when after very little rumination he began it, his early self dropped from him with his boyhood dialect and the jargon of his late associates. He was all the easy cosmopolitan telling his tale with conscious zest. As if it had been broad day, Thwaite drove the car at a terrific pace for nearly an hour. Then he stopped it while Riven put out every lamp. We had not met or overtaken anything, but when we started again through the moist starless blackness, it was too much for my nerves. Thwaite was as cool as if he could see. I could not so much as guess at him in front of me, but I could feel self-confidence in every quiver of the car. It was one of those super expensive makes, which are, on any gear, at any speed, on any grade, as noiseless as a puma. Thwaite never hesitated in the gloom. He kept straight or swerved, crept or darted, whizzed or crawled for nearly an hour more. Then he turned sharp to the left and uphill. I could feel and smell the soaked, hanging boughs close above and about me, the wet foliage on them, and the deep sodden earth mold that squelched under the tires. We climbed steeply, came to a level, and then backed and went forward at length, or so a half dozen times turning. Then we stopped dead. Thwaite moved things that clicked or thumped, and presently said, "Now I'll demonstrate how a man can fill his gasoline tank in the pitch dark if he knows the touch system." After some more time, he said, "Riven, go bury this." Riven swore but went. Braithwaite climbed in beside me. When Riven returned, he climbed in on the other side of me. He lit his pipe. Thwaite lit a cigar and looked at his watch. After I had lit too, Thwaite said, "We've plenty of time to talk here, and all you have to do is listen. I'll begin at the beginning. When old Hiram Eversley died..." "You don't mean..." I interrupted him.
"Shut up," he snapped. "Keep your mouth shut. You'll have your say when I've done."
I shut up. "When old man Eversley died," he resumed, "the income of the fortune was divided equally among his sons. You know what the others did with their shares. Palaces in New York and London and Paris, chateau on the Breton coast, deer and grouse moors in Scotland, steam yachts and all the rest of it, the same as they have kept it up ever since. At first, Vortigern Eversley went in for all that sort of thing, harder than any one of his brothers. But when his wife died, more than 40 years ago, he stopped all that once. He sold everything else, bought this place, put the wall around it, and built that infinity of structures inside. You've seen the pinnacles and roofs of them, and that's all anybody I ever talked to has ever seen of them, since they were finished about 5 years after his wife's death. You've seen the two gatehouses, and you know each is big even for a millionaire's mansion. You can judge of the size and extent of the complication of buildings that make up the castle or mansion house, or whatever you choose to call it. There Vortigern Eversley lived. Not once did he ever leave it that I can learn of. There he died. Since his death, full 20 years ago, his share of the Eversley income has been paid to his heir. No one has ever seen that heir. From what I'll tell you presently, you'll see, as I have, that the heir's probably not a woman. But nobody knows anything about him. He has never been outside these miles of wall, yet not one of the greedy, selfish Eversley grandsons and granddaughters and son-in-laws and daughter-in-laws has ever objected to the payment to that heir of the full entire portion of Vortigern Eversley. And that portion has been $200,000 a month, paid in gold on the first banking day of each month. I found that out for sure, for there have been disputes about the division of Wolfstan Eversley's share and of Cedric Eversley's share, and I made certain from the papers in the suits. All that money, or the value of it, has been either reinvested or spent inside that park wall. Not much has been reinvested. I got on the track of the heir's purchases. He buys musical instruments in any quantity and at any price. Those were the first things I made sure of. And artist materials, paints, brushes, canvas, tools, woods, clay, marble, tons of clay, and great blocks of superfine grained marble. He's no magpie collecting expensive trash for a whim. He knows what he wants and why. He has taste. He buys horses and saddlery and carriages, furniture and carpets and tapestries, pictures, all landscapes, never any figure pictures. He buys photographs of pictures by the 10,000, and he buys fine porcelains, rare vases, table silver, ornaments of Venetian glass, silver and gold filigree, jewelry, watches, chains, gems, pearls, rubies, emeralds, and diamonds. Diamonds. Thwaite's voice shook with excitement, though he kept as soft and even. "Oh, I did 2 years investigating," he went on. "I know. People bab. But not any of the servants or grooms or gardeners. Not a word could I get at first or second or third hand from any or any of their relatives or friends. They keep dumb. They know which side their bread is buttered on. But some of the discharged tradesmen's assistants told all I wanted to know, and I got it straight, though not direct. No one from outside ever gets into that place beyond the big paved courtyards of the gatehouse. Every bit of supplies for all that regiment of servants goes into the brownstone gatehouse. The outer gates open, and the wagon, or whatever it is, drives under the archway. there it halts. The outer gates shut and the inner gates open. It drives into the courtyard. Then the major domo, I suppose that wouldn't be too big a name for him, makes his selections. The inner gates of the other gateway open, and the wagon drives under the archway and halts. The inner gates close fast and the outer gates open. That's the way with every wagon, and only one enters at a time. Everything is carried through the gatehouse to the smaller inner courtyard and loaded on the wagons of the estate to be driven up to the mansion. Everything, like furniture, for instance, comes into the courtyard of the greenstone gatehouse. There a sort of auditor verifies the inventory and receipts for the goods before two witnesses from the dealers and two for the estate. The consignment may be kept a day or a month. It may be returned intact or kept entire. Any difference is settled for at once upon return of what is rejected. So with jewelry. I had luck. I found out for certain that more than $1 million worth of diamonds alone have gone into this place in the last 10 years and stayed there. Thwaite paused dramatically. I never said a word, and we sat there in the rear seat of that stationary auto, the leather creaking as we breathed, ribbons sucking at his pipe and the leaves dripping above us. Not another sound. "It's all in there," Thwaite began again. "The biggest stack of loot in North America. And this is going to be the biggest and most successful burglary ever perpetrated on this continent. And no one will ever be convicted for it, or so much as suspected of it. Mark my words." "I do," I broke in. "And I don't feel a bit better than when we started. You promised to explain, and you said I'd be as eager and confident as you and Riven." "I acknowledge the bait, admitting all you said is true, and it doesn't seem likely. But do you suppose any recluse millionaire eccentric is going to live unguarded? If he is careless himself, his household are the reverse. By what you tell the gatehouses, there are precautions enough. Diamonds are tempting if you like that, but so is the bullion and the mint. By your account, all this accumulation of treasure you imagine is as safe where it is as the gold reserve in the United States Treasury. You scare me. You don't reassure me." "Keep your head," Thwaite interrupted. "I'm no fool. I've spent years on this scheme. After I was sure of the prize, I made sure of the means. There are precautions, a many, but not enough. How simple to put a watchman's cottage every 100 yards on the other side of the road, across from the wall. They haven't done it. How simple to light the road and the outside of the wall. They haven't done that. Nor have they thought of any one of the 20 other simple outside precautions. The park's big enough to be lonely, and outside the wall is all dark, lonely road and unfenced, empty woods like this. They're overconfident. They think their wall and their gatehouses are enough, and they are not. They think their outside precautions are perfect. They are not. I know. I've been over that wall 10 times, 20 times, 50 times. I've risked it, and I've risked man-traps and spring guns and alarm wires. There aren't any. There isn't any night patrol, nor any regular day patrol. Only casual gardeners and such. I know. I made sure of it by crawling all over the place on my belly, like an Iroquois Indian in one of Cooper's novels. They are so confident of the potency of their wall that they haven't so much as a watchdog, nor any dog of any kind." I was certainly startled. "No dog?" I exclaimed. "Are you sure?" "Dead sure," Thwaite returned in triumphantly. "And sure there never has been a dog in the place." "How could you be sure of that?" I cavilled. "I'm coming to that," Thwaite went on. "I could not get anybody that ever belonged to the place to talk. But I managed to arrange to overhear two of them talking to each other, and more than once, too. Most of what they said was no use to me, but I overheard scraps I could piece together. There's a cross wall that divides the park. In the smaller division into which the lodge gates lead are the homes of all the caretakers and servants, of the overseers and manager, and of the estate doctor, for there is an estate doctor. He has 2 assistants, young men frequently changed. He is married, like most of the retinue. There's a sort of village of them inside the outer wall, outside the inner cross wall. Some of them have been there 35 years. When they get too old, they're pensioned off and sent away somewhere, far off, for I could not get a clue to any pensioner. The valets or keepers, whichever they are, and there are many of them, to relieve each other, are all unmarried except two or three of the most trusted. The rest are all brought over from England and shipped back usually after 5 or 4 years of service. The men I overheard were two of these. An old hand soon to finish his enlistment, as he called it, and go home, and the lad he was training to take his place. All these specials have plenty of time off to spend outside. They'd sit over their beer for 2 or 3 hours at a time, chatting on. Appleshaw giving points to Kitworth, or Kitworth asking questions. I learned from them about the crosswall. Never's been a woman to the other side of it since it was built, Appleshaw said. I shouldn't have thought it, Kitworth ruminated. Can you imagine a woman, Appleshaw asked, standing him? No, Kitworth admitted, I hardly can. But someone will stand more than a man. Anyhow, Appleshaw added, he can't abide the sight of a woman.
Odd, said Kitworth. I've heard his kind are all the other way.
They are, as we know, Appleshaw replied, having watched them, but he ain't. He can't endure 'em.
I suppose it's the same way about dogs, Kitworth reflected.
No dogs ever get used to him, Appleshaw agreed, and he's that afraid of dogs. They're not allowed inside the place anywhere. Never's been one here since he was born, I'm told. No, nor any cat either. Not one even. Another time I heard Appleshaw say, he built the museums and the pavilion and the towers. The rest was built before he grew up. Generally, I could not hear much of Kitworth's utterances. He talked so low. I once heard Appleshaw reply, sometimes nights and nights he'll be as quiet as anybody. Lights out early and sleep sound for all we know. Again, he'll be up all night, every window blazing, or up late, till after midnight. Whoever's on duty sees the night out. Nobody else's business, unless they send an alarm for help, and that ain't often, not twice a year. Mostly he's as quiet as you or me, as long as he's obeyed. His temper's short, though. Now he'll fly into a rage if he's not answered quick. Again, he'll storm if the watchers come near him uncalled. Of long inaudible whispers, I caught fragments. Once. Oh, then he'll have no one near. You can hear him sobbing like a child. When he's worse, you'll hear him still nights howling and screaming like a lost soul. Again. Clean fleshed as a child and no more hairy than you or me. Again. Fiddle? No violinist can beat him. I've listened hours. It makes you think of your sins. And then it'll change and you remember your first sweetheart in spring, rains and flowers, and when you was a child on your mother's knee. It tears your heart out. The two phrases that seem to mean most were, he won't stand any interference. And never a lock touched till daylight after he's once locked in. Now what do you think? Thwaite asked me. It sounds, I said, as if the place were a one-patient asylum for a lunatic with long, lucid intervals.
Something like that, Thwaite answered, but there seems to be more in it than that. I can't make all the things I hear fit.
Appleshaw said one thing that runs in my head. Seen him in the suds. Give me a turn. And Kitworth said once, it was the bright colors alongside of it that made my blood run cold. And Appleshaw said more than once in varying words, but always with the same meaning tone, you'll never get over being afraid of him, but you'll respect him more and more. You'll almost love him. You won't fear him for his looks, but for his awful wisdom. He's that wise. No man is more so. Once Kitworth answered, I don't envy Story locked in there with him. Story nor none of us that's his most trusted man for the time being is not to be envied," Appleshaw agreed. "But you'll come to it as I have, for if you're the man I take you for." That's about all I got from listening. Thwaite went on. "The rest I got from watching and scouting. I made sure of the building they call the pavilion. That's his usual home. But sometimes he spends his nights in one or other of the towers. They stand all by themselves. Sometimes the lights are all out after 10 o'clock, or even 9, then again they're still on after midnight. Sometimes they come on late, 2 or 3. I've heard music, too, violin music, as Appleshaw described it, and organ music, too, but no howling. He is certainly a lunatic, judging by the statuary." "Statuary?" I queried. "Yes," Thwaite said. "Statuary. Big figures and groups, all crazy men with heads like elephants or American eagles. Perfectly crazy statuary, but all well done. They stand all about the park. The little square building between the pavilion and the green towers is sculpture studio." "You seem to know the place mighty well," I said. "I do," Thwaite assented. "I've gotten to know it well. At first I tried nights like this. Then I dared starlight. Then I dared even moonlight. I've never had a scare. I've sat on the front steps of the pavilion at 1 o'clock of starlight night and never been challenged. I even tried staying in all day, hiding in some bushes, hoping to see him." "Ever see him?" I inquired. "Never," Thwaite answered. "I've heard him, though. He rides horseback after dark. I watched the horse being led up and down in front of the pavilion till it got too dark to see it from where I was hid. I've heard it pass me in the dark. But I could never get the horse against the sky to see what was on it. Hiding and getting downhill of a road close to it don't go together." "You didn't see him the day you spent there?" I insisted. "No," Thwaite said, "I didn't. I was disappointed, too. For a big auto purred up to the pavilion entrance and stood under the porte cochere. But when it spun round the park, there was nobody in it. Only a chauffeur in front and a pet monkey on the back seat." "A pet monkey?" I exclaimed. "Yes," he said. "You know how a dog, a Newfoundland or a terrier, will sit up in an auto and look grand and superior and enjoy himself. Well, that monkey sat there just like that, turning his head one way and the other, taking in the view." "What was he like?" I asked. "Sort of a dog-faced ape," Thwaite told me. "More like a mastiff," Riven grunted. "This isn't business," Thwaite went on. "We've got to get down to business. The point is the wall is your only guard. There's no dog, perhaps because of the pet monkey as much as anything else. They lock Mr. Eversley up every night with only one valet to care of him. They never interfere whatever noise they hear or light they see, unless the alarm is sent out, and I have located the alarm wires you are to cut. That's all. Do you go?" Riven was sitting close to me, half on me. I could feel his great muscles and the butt of his pistol against my hip. "I come with you," I said. "Of your own accord?" Thwaite insisted. The butt of that pistol moved as Riven breathed. "I come of my own accord," I said. Afoot, Thwaite left as confidently as he had driven the car. It was the stillest, pitchiest night I ever experienced, without light, air, sound, or smell to guide anyone. Through that fog, Thwaite sped like a man moving about his own bedroom, never for a second at a loss. "Here's the place," he said, at the wall, and guided my hand to feel the ring bolt in the grass at its foot. Riven made a back for him, and I scrambled up on the two. Tiptoe on Thwaite's shoulders, I could just finger the coping. "Stand on my head, you fool," he whispered. I clutched the coping. Once astraddle of it, I sat down one end of the silk ladder. "Fast," breathed Thwaite from below. I drew it taut and went down. The first sweep of my fingers in the grass found the other ring bolt. I made the ladder fast and gave it the signal twitches. Riven came over first, then Thwaite. Through the park he led evenly. When he halted, he caught me by the elbow and asked, "Can you see any lights?" "Not a light," I told him. "Same here," he said. "There are no lights. Every window is dark. We're in luck." he let again for a while. Stopping, he said only, "Here's what you shin up. Cut every wire, but don't waste time cutting any twice." The details of his directions were exact. I found every handhold and foothold as he had schooled me. But I needed all my nerve. I realized that no heavyweight like Riven or Thwaite could have done it. When I came down, I was limp and tottery. "Just one swallow," Thwaite said, putting a flask to my lips. Then we went on. The night was so black and the fog so thick that I saw no loom of the building till we were against this wall. "Here's where you go in," Thwaite directed. Doubly I understood why I was with them. Neither could have squeezed through the aperture in the stone. I barely managed it. Inside, instead of the sliding crash I had dreaded, I landed with a mere crunch. The coal in that bin was not anthracite. Likewise, the bin under the window was for soft coal. I blessed my luck and felt encouraged. The window I got open without too much work. Riven and Thwaite slid in. We crunched downhill 4 or 5 steps and stood on a firm floor. Riven flashed his electric candle boldly around. We were between a suite of trim coal bins and a battery of serried furnaces. There was no door at either end of the open space in which we stood. I had a momentary vision of the alternate windows and coal chutes above the bins, of 2 big panels of shiny colored tilling, of clear brickwork, fresh painted, jetty iron and dazzling white brass-ringed asbestos, of a black vacancy between 2 furnaces. Toward that I half heard, half felt Riven turn. During the rest of our adventure he led. Thwaite followed and I mostly tagged, or groped after Thwaite, often judging of their position or movements by that combination of senses which is neither hearing nor touch, though partly both. Riven's torch flashed again. We were in a cement-floored, brick-walled passage, with a door at each end, on the side facing up doors in a bewildering row. In the darkness that came after the flash, I followed the others to the right. Well through the doorway we stood, still breathing and listening. When Riven illuminated our environment, we saw about us thousands of bottles, all set aslant, neck down, in tiers of racks that reached to the ceiling. Edging between them, we made the circuit of the cellar, but found no sign of any door save that by which we had entered. A whispered growl from Riven, a nudge from Thwaite, and we went back the full length of the passage. Again we found ourselves in a wine vault, the duplicate of that we had left, and with the same peculiarity. Our curiosity overcame any prudence. Riven, instead of flashing his torch at intervals, kept the light steady, and we scrutinized, examined, and whispered our astonishment. As in its fellow, there was not in all this vault any spare space. The aisles were narrow. The racks reached the girder supporting the flat arches. Every rack was so full that a holder empty of its bottle was scarcely findable. And there was not in all that great cellar, there was not among all those tens of thousands of bottles, a magnum, or a quart, or even a pint. They were all splits. We handled the number, and all had the same label. I know now what the device was, from seeing it so often and so much larger afterwards. But there it seemed the picture of a skirt dancer leading an alligator by a dog chain. There was no name of any wine or liquor on any bottle, but each label had a red number, 17 or 45 or 328 above the picture, and under it, "Bottled for Hengist Eversley." "We know his name now," Thwaite whispered. Back in the passage, Riven took the first door to the left. It brought us to an easy stone stair between walls, which turned twice to the left at broad landings. When we trod a softer footing, we stood a long time, breathing cautiously and listening. Presently, Riven flashed his light. It showed to our left a carpeted stair, the dull red carpet bulging up over thick pads and held down by brass stair rods. The polished quartered oak of the molded door jamb or end of wainscot beyond it, the floor covering of brownish yellow or yellowish brown linoleum or something similar, made to look like inlaid wood, and the feet, legs, and thighs of a big stocky man. The light shone but the fraction of a second, yet it showed plain his knee breeches, tight stockings on his big calves, and bright buckles at his knees and on his low shoes. There was no loud sound, but the blurred, brushy noise of a mute struggle. I backed against a window sill and could go back no further. All I could hear was the shuffling, rasping sounds of the fight and panting that became a sort of gurgle. Again the light flashed and stayed full bright. I saw that it was Thwaite struggling with the man and that one of his big hands was on Thwaite's throat. Thwaite had him round the neck and his face was against Thwaite's chest. His hair was brownish. Ribbons slung shot crunched horribly on his skull. Instantly the light went out. Thwaite, radiating heat like a stove, stood gasping close by me. I heard no other noise after the body thudded on the floor, except that on the carpeted stair I seemed to hear light treads, as it were of a big dog or of a frightened child padding away upward. "Did you hear anything?" I whispered. Riven punched me. After Thwaite was breathing naturally, he turned on his torch and Riven did the same. The dead man was oldish, over 50, I should judge, tall, large in all his dimensions and spare, though heavy. His clothing was a gold lace livery of green velvet, with green velvet knee breeches, green silk stockings, and green leather pumps. The four buckles were gold. Thwaite startled me by speaking out loud. "I take it, Riven," he said, "this is the trusted valet." He would have yelled if there had been anybody to call. "Either we have this building to ourselves, or we have no one to deal with except Mr. Hengist Eversley." Riven grunted. "If he is here," Thwaite went on, "he's trying to send the alarm over the cut wires. Or he's frightened and hiding. Let's find him and finish him, if he's here, and then find his diamonds. Anyway, let's find those diamonds." Riven grunted. Swiftly they led from room to room and floor to floor. Not a door resisted. We had been curious and astonished in the wine vaults. Above, we were electrified and numb. We were in a palace of wonders, among such a profusion of valuables that even Riven, after the second or third opportunity, ceased any attempt to pocket or bag anything. We came upon nothing living, found no door locked, and apparently made the tour of the entire building. When they halted, I halted. We were delirious with amazement, frantic with inquisitiveness, frenzied with curiosity, incredulous, hysterical, dazed, and quivering. Thwaite spoke in the dark. "I'm going to see this place plain, all over it, if I die for it." They flashed their torches. We were right beside the body of the murdered footman. Riven and Thwaite did not seem to mind the corpse. They waved their torches until one fell on an electric light button. "Hope those wires are underground," Thwaite remarked. He pushed the button and the electric lights came on full and strong. We were apparently at the foot of the back stairs, in a sort of lobby, an expanded passageway out of which opened several doors. We all three regarded the knobs of those doors. As we had half seen by flashlight on every door everywhere, each door had two knobs, one like any doorknob, the other about halfway between it and the floor. Riven opened one which proved to lead into a broom closet. He tried the knobs, Thwaite and I watching too. The lock and latch were at the upper knob, but controlled by either knob indifferently. They tried another door, but my eyes would roam to the dead body. Riven and Thwaite paid no more attention to it than if it had not been there. I had never seen but one killed man before, and neither wanted to be reminded of that one, nor relished the sight of this one. I stared down the blackness of the stone stair up which we had come, or glanced into the dimness of the padded stairway. Then Riven, feeling inside the open door, found the button and turned on the lights. It was a biggish dining room, the four corners cut off by inset glass frame shelves, closets full of china and glassware. The furniture was oak. "Servants' dining room," Thwaite commented. Turning on the lights, in each we went through a series of rooms, a sort of sitting room with card tables and checkerboards, a library walled with bookcases. and open bookshelves, its two stout oak tables littered with magazines and newspapers, a billiard room with three tables, a billiard table, a pool table, and one for bagatelle, a sort of lounging room, all leather-covered sofa and deep armchairs, an entry with hat hooks and umbrella stands, the outer door dark oak with a great deal of stained glass set in and around it. All servants' room, Thwaite commented. Every bit of the furniture is natural man size. Let's go on. Back we went along a passage into a big kitchen beyond the dining room. Never mind the pantries till we come down again, Thwaite commanded. Let's go upstairs. We'll do the banqueting hall after those bedrooms, and the writing rooms and study last. I want a real sight of those pictures. They passed the dead flunky as if he had not been there at all. On the floor above Thwaite, touched Riven's elbow. I forgot these, he said. We inspected a medium-sized sitting room with a round center table, an armchair drawn up by it, and in the armchair magazine and a sort of wadded smoking jacket. Next, this room was a bedroom and a bathroom. Mr. Footman's quarters, Thwaite remarked, staring unconcernedly at a photograph of a dumpy young woman and two small children set on the bureau. All man-sized furniture here, too. Riven nodded. Up the second flight of that back stair we went again. It ended in a squarish hallway or lobby or room with nothing in it but two settees. It had two doors. Riven pushed one open, felt up and down for the electric button, and found it. We all three gasped. We almost shouted. We had had glimpses of this gallery before, but the flood of light from 1,000 bulbs under inverted trough reflectors dazzled us. The pictures fairly petrified us. The glare terrified me. Surely we are crazy, I objected, to make all this illumination. It's certain to give the alarm. Alarm nothing, Thwaite snapped. Haven't I watched these buildings night after night? I told you he is never disturbed at any hour. Lights or no lights. My feeble protest thus brushed away, I became absorbed, like the others, in those incredible paintings. Riven was merely stupidly dazed in uncomprehending wonder. Thwaite, keenly speculative, questing for a clue to the origin of their peculiarities. I, totally bewildered at the perfection of their execution, shivering at their uncanniness. The gallery was all of 90 feet long, nearly 30 wide and high. Apparently it had a glass roof above the rectangle of reflectors. The pictures covered all four walls, except a little door at either end. None was very small, and several were very large. A few were landscapes, but all had figures in them. Most were crowded with figures. Those figures. They were human figures, but not one had a human head. The heads were invariably those of birds, animals, or fishes, generally of animals, some of common animals, many of creatures I had seen pictures of or had heard of, some of imaginary creatures like dragons or griffins, more than half of the heads either of animals I knew nothing of or which had been invented by the painter. Close to me, when the lights blazed out, was a sea picture. Blurred, grayish, foggy weather and a heavy groundswell. A strange otherworld open boat with fish heaped in the bottom of it, and standing among them four human figures in shining boots like rubber boots and wet, shiny, loose coats like oilskins. Only the boots and skins were red as claret, and the four figures had hyena heads. One was steering, and the others were hauling at a net. Caught in the net was a sort of merman, but different from the pictures of mermaids. His shape was all human, except the head and hands and feet. Every bit of him was covered with fish scales, all rainbowy. He had flat, broad fins in place of hands and feet, and his head was the head of a fat hog. He was thrashing about in the net in an agony of impotent effort. Queer as the picture was, it had a compelling impression of reality, as if the scene were actually happening before our eyes. Next, it was a picnic in a little meadow by a pond between woods with mountains behind it higher up. Every one of the picnickers about the white tablecloth spread on the grass had the head of a different animal. one of them a sheep, one of a camel, and the rest of animals, like deer. Not one of them known to me. Then next to me was a fight of two compound creatures shaped like centers. Only they had bulls' bodies, with human torsos growing out of them, where the necks ought to be the arms, scaly snakes with open mouth, biting heads in place of hands. And instead of human heads, roosters' heads, bills open and pecking. Under the creatures, in place of bulls' hoofs, were yellow rooster legs, stouter than the chicken legs, and with short, thick toes and long, sharp spurs like game roosters. Yet these fantastic chimeras appeared altogether alive, and their movements looked natural. Yes, that's the word, natural. Every picture was as complete a staggerer as these first three. Everyone was signed in the lower left-hand corner in neat, smallish letters of bright gold paint. Hengist Eversley. And a date. "Mr. Hengist Eversley is a lunatic, that's certain," Thwaite commented. "But he unquestionably knows how to paint." There must have been more than 50 pictures in that gallery. Maybe as many as 75, and every one a nightmare. Beyond was a shorter gallery of the same width, end on to the side of the first, and beyond that the duplicate of the first, the three taking up three sides of the building. The fourth side was a studio, the size of the second gallery. It had a great skylight of glass, tiled sideways, all along one whole wall. It was whitewashed, very plain and empty-looking, with two easels, a big one and a little one. On the little one was a picture of some vegetables and five or six little fairies, as it were, with children's bodies and mice's head nibbling at a carrot. On the big one was a canvas mostly blank. One side of it had a palm tree in splashy, thick slabs of paint, and under it three big crabs with coconuts in their claws. A man's feet and legs showed beside them, and the rest was unfinished. The three galleries had fully 300 paintings, for the smaller gallery contained only small canvases. Besides being impressed with the grotesqueness of the subjects and the perfection of the drawing and coloring, two things struck me as to the pictures collectively. First, there was not represented in any one of all those paintings any figure of a woman or any female shape of any kind. The beast-headed figures were all, whether clothed or nude, figures of men. The animals, as far as I could see, were all males. Secondly, nearly half of the pictures were modifications or parallels or emulations, I could hardly say travesties or imitations, of well-known pictures by great artists. Paintings I had seen in public galleries, or knew from engravings or photographs or reproductions in books or magazines. There was a picture like Washington crossing the Delaware, and another like Washington saying farewell to his generals. There was a batch of Napoleon pictures after the paintings of Napoleon at Austerlitz, at Friedland, giving the eagles to his regiments on the morning of Waterloo, coming down the steps at Fontainebleau, and on the deck of the ship going to St. Helena. There were dozens of other pictures of generals or kings or emperors reviewing victorious armies, two or three of Lincoln. One that hit me hardest, obviously, after some picture I had never seen or heard of the ghost of Lincoln, far larger than a life-size man, towering above the surviving notabilities of his time, on the grandstand reviewing the homecoming federal army marching through Washington. And every one of these pictures, the dominant figure, whether it stood for Lincoln, Napoleon, Washington, or some other general or ruler, whatever uniform or regalia clothed its human shape, had the same head. The heads of the fighting men in all these pictures were those of dogs, all alike in any one picture, but differing from one to another, terriers or wolfhounds or mastiffs or whatnot. The heads of any men not soldiers were those of oxen or sheep or horses or some other mild sort of animal. The head of the dominant figure I then took to be invented, legendary, fabulous. Oh, that's not the word I want. Mythological, I suggested, the only interruption I interjected into his entire narrative. Yes, mythological, he returned. I thought it was a mythological creature. the long-jawed head like a hound's, the little pointed yellow beard under the chin, the black naked ears like a hairless dog's ear, and yet not doggy either, the ridge of hair on top of the skull, the triangular shape of the whole head, the close-set, small, beady, terribly knowing eyes, the brilliant patches of color on either side of the muzzle, all these made a piercing impression of individuality and yet seemed not so much actual as mythological. It takes a great deal longer to tell what we saw on that third floor than it took to see it. All around the galleries, under the pictures, were cases of drawers solidly built in one length like a counter and about as high. Thwaite went down one side of the gallery and Riven down the other, pulling them out and slamming them shut again. All I saw held photographs of pictures, but Riven and Thwaite were taking no chances and looked into every drawer. I had plenty of time to gaze about me and circulated at a sort of cantering trot around the green velvet miniature sofas and settees placed back to back down the middle of the floor space. It seemed to me that Mr. Hengist Eversley was a great master of figure and landscape drawing, color, light, and perspective. As we went down the duplicate staircase at the other corner from where we came up, Thwaite said, "Now for those bedrooms." By the stair we found another valet or footman's apartment, sitting room, bedroom, and bathroom, just like the one by the other stair. And there were four more between them, under the studio and over the lounging rooms. On the east and west sides of the building were the bedrooms, 12 apartments, 6 on each side, each of the 12 made up of a bedroom, a dressing room, and a bathroom. The beds were about 3 feet long and proportionately narrow and low. The furniture, bureaus, tables, chairs, chests of drawers, and the rest harmonized with the dimensions of the beds, except the cheval glasses and wall mirrors, which reached the ceilings. The bathtubs were almost pools, about 9 feet by 6 and all of 3 feet deep, each a single block of porcelain. The shapes and sizes and styles of the furniture were duplicated all through, but the colors varied, so that the 12 suites were in 12 colors, black, white, gray, and brown, and light and dark yellow, red, green, and blue, wall coverings, hangings, carpets, and rugs, all to match in each suite. The panels of the walls had the same picture, however repeated over and over, 2, 4, or 6 times to a room and in every suite alike. This picture was a design I had failed to make out on the labels of the bottles. It was set as a medallion in each panel of the blue or red walls, or whatever other color they were. The background of the picture was a vague sort of palish sky and blurred hazy shadows above tropical-looking foliage. The chief figure was an angel in flowing white robes, floating on silvery-plumed wings widespread. The angel's face was a human face, the only human face in any picture in that place, the face of a grave, gentle, rather girlish young man. The creature the angel was leading was a huge, bulky crocodile with a gold collar about its neck and a gold chain from that, not to the angel's hand, but to a gold fetter about his wrist. Under each picture was a verse of 4 lines, always the same. "Let not your baser nature drag you down. Utter no whimper, not one sigh or moan. Hopeless of respite, soulless palm or crown. Live out your life unflinching and alone." I saw it so often, I shall never forget it. The bathrooms were luxurious and the extreme. A needle bath, a shower bath, 2 basins of different sizes in each, besides a sunk pool tub. The dressing rooms had a variety of wardrobes. 1 or 2 were opened, finding it in each several suits of little clothes, as if for a boy under 6 years old. 1 closet had shelf above shelf of small shoes, not much over 4 inches long. "Evidently," Thwaite remarked, "Hengist Eversley is a dwarf." "Whatever else he is," Riven left the wardrobes and closets alone after the first view. Each bedroom had in it nothing but the bed, and on each side of it a sort of wine cooler, like a pail with a lid, but bigger, set on three short legs so that the top was level with the bed. We opened most of them. Everyone we opened was filled with ice, bedded in which were several half-pint bottles. Every one of the 12 beds had the covers carefully turned down. Not one showed any sign of having been occupied. The wine coolers were solid silver, but we left them where they were. As Thwaite remarked, it would have taken 2 full-sized freight cars to contain the silver we had seen. In the dressing room, the articles like brushes and combs on the bureaus were all of gold, and most set with jewels. Riven began to fill a bag with those entirely of metal, but even he made no attempt to tear the backs off the brushes or to waste energy on any other breakage. By the time we had scanned the 12 suites, Riven could barely carry his bag. The front room on the south side of the building was a library full of small, showily bound books in glass-fronted cases, all the way to the ceiling, covering every wall except with the 2 doors and 6 windows open. There were small, narrow tables, the height of those in the dressing rooms. There were magazines on them and papers. Thwaite opened a bookcase and I another, and we looked at 3 or 4 books. Each had in it a bookplate, with a device of the angel and the crocodile. Riven did not find the electric button in the main hallway, and we went down the great, broad, curving stair by our electric candle. Riven turned to the left, and we found ourselves in the banquet hall, as Thwaite had called it, a room all of 40 by 30 and gorgeous beyond any description. The diminutive table, not 3 feet square, was a slab of crystal-white glass set on silver-covered legs. The tiny armchair, the only chair in the big room, was solid silver, with a crimson cushion loose in it. The sideboards and glass-fronted closets paralyzed us. One had fine china and cut glass, wonderful china glass, but 4 held a table service of gold, all of pure gold. Forks, knives, spoons, plates, bowls, platters, cups, everything, all miniature, but a profusion of everything. We hefted the pieces. They were gold. All the pieces were normal in shape, except that instead of wine glasses, goblets and tumblers were things like broad gravy boats on stems or short feet, all lopsided with 1 projecting edge like the mouth of a pitcher, only broader and flatter. There were dozens of these. Riven filled 2 bags with what 2 bags would hold. The 3 bags were all we 3 could carry. Must have been over 150 pounds apiece. "We'll have to make 2 trips up to the wall," Thwaite said. "You bought 6 bags, didn't you, Riven?" Riven grunted. At the foot of the grand staircase, Riven found the electric button and flooded the magnificent stairway with light. The stair itself was all white marble, the rails yellow marble, and the paneling of the dado malachite. But the main feature was the painting above the landing. This was the most amazing of all the paintings we had come upon. I remembered something like it, an advertisement of a root beer talcum powder, or some other proprietary article, representing all the nations of the earth, and their rulers in the foreground, congratulating the orator. This picture was about 20 feet wide and higher than its width. There was a throne, a carved and jeweled throne, set on an eminence. There was a wide view on either side of the throne, and all filled with human figures with animal heads, an infinite throng all facing the throne. Nearest it were figures that seemed meant for all the presidents and kings and queens and emperors of the world. I recognized the robes or uniforms of some of them. Some had heads taken from their national coat of arms, like the heads of the Austrian and Russian eagles. All these figures were paying homage to the figure that stood before the throne, the same monster we had seen in place of Lincoln or Washington or Napoleon in the paintings upstairs. He stood proudly with 1 foot on a massive crocodile. He was dressed in a sort of revolutionary uniform, low shoes with gold buckles, white stockings and knee breeches, a red waistcoat and a bright blue coat. His head was the same beast head of the other pictures, triangular and strange, which I had then thought mythological. Above and behind the throne floated in outspread silver wings the white-robed angel with a Sir Galahad face. Riven shut off the lights almost instantly, but even in the few breaths while I looked, I saw it all. The three sacks of swag we put down by the front door. The room opposite the banquet hall was a music room with an organ and a piano, both with keys and keyboards far smaller than usual. Great cases of music books, an array of brass instruments and cellos, and more than 100 violin cases. Thwaite opened one or two. "These be enough to make our fortune," he said, "if we could get away with them." Beyond the music room was the study. It had in it four desks, miniature in size, and the old-fashioned model with drawers below, a lid to turn down, and from it a writing desk and a sort of bookcase above with a peak top. All were carved, and on the lids in the carving we read, "Journal, Music, Criticism, Business." Thwaite opened the desk marked "Business" and pulled open the drawers. In pigeonholes of the desk were bundles of new clean greenbacks and treasury notes of higher denominations, 5 each of 5s, 10s, 20s, 50s, and 100s. Thwaite tossed one bundle of each to me and Riven and pocketed the rest. He bulged. One drawer had a division down the middle. One half was full of $10 gold pieces, the other half of 20s. "I've heard of misers," said Thwaite, "but this beats hell. Think of that crazy dwarf, a prisoner in this place, running his hands through this and gloating over the cash he can never use." Riven loaded a big bag with a coin, and when he had them all, he could barely lift the bag. Leaving it where it lay before the desk, he strode the length of the room and tried the door at the end. It was fast. Instantly, Riven and Thwaite were like two terriers after a rat. "This is where the diamonds are," Thwaite declared, "and Mr. Hengist Eversley is in there with them." He and Riven conferred a while together. "You kneel low," Thwaite whispered. "Duck when you open it. He'll fire over you. Then you've got him, see?" Riven tiptoed to the door, knelt, and tried key after key in the lock. There were at least 20 bulbs in the chandelier of that room, and the light beat down on him. His red neck dewlapped over the low collar of his lavenderish shirt. His great broad back showed vast and powerful. On the other side of the doorway, Thwaite stood, his finger at the electric button. Each had a slung shot in his left hand. They had spun the cylinders of the revolvers and stuck them in their belts in front before Riven began work on the lock. I heard a click. Riven put up his hand. The lights went out. In the black dark we stood. Stood until I could almost see the outlines of the windows, less black against the intense blackness. Soon I heard another click, and the grate of an open door. Then a kind of snarl, a thump like a blow, a sort of strangling gasp, and the cushiony sound of a struggle. Thwaite turned on the light. Riven was in the act of staggering up from his knees. I saw a pair of small pink hands, the fingers intertwined, locked behind Riven's neck. They slipped apart as I caught sight of them. I had a vision of small feet and little patent leather silver-buckled low shoes, of green socks, of diminutive legs and white trousers flashing right and left in front of Riven, as if he held by the throat a struggling child. Next I saw that his arms were thrown up wide apart. He collapsed and fell back his full length with a dull crash. Then I saw the snout, saw the wolf-jaws vised on his throat, saw the blood welling round the dazzling white fangs, and recognized the reality of the sinister head I had seen over and over in his pictures. Riven made the fish-out-of-water contortions of a man being killed. Thwaite brought his slung shot down on the beast head skull. The blow was enough to crush in a steel cylinder. The beast wrinkled its snout and shook its head from side to side, whirring like a bulldog at Riven's throat. Again Thwaite struck, and again. At each blow, the portentous head oscillated viciously. The awful thing about it to me was the two blue bosses on each side of the muscle, like enamel, shiny and hard-looking, and the hideous welt of red, like fresh sealing wax, down between them and along the snout. Riven's struggles grew weaker as the great teeth tore at his throat. He was dead before Thwaite's repeated blows drove in the splintered skull and the clenched jaws relaxed, the snout crinkling and contracting as the dog teeth slid from their hold. Thwaite gave the monster two or three more blows, touched Riven, and fairly dashed out of the room, shouting, "You stay here!" I heard the sound of prying and sawing. There alone, I looked but once at the dead cracksman. The thing that had killed him was the size of a 46-year-old child, but more stockily built, looked entirely human up to the neck, and was dressed in a coat of bright dark blue, a vest of crimson velvet, and white duck trousers. As I looked, the muzzle wiggled for the last time, the jaws fell apart, and the carcass rolled sideways. It was a very duplicated miniature of the figure in the big picture on the staircase landing. Thwaite came back. Without any sign of any qualm, he searched Riven and tossed me two or three bundles of greenbacks. He stood up. He laughed. "Curiosity," he said, "will be the death of me." Then he stripped the clothing from the dead monster kneeling by it. The beast's hair stopped at the shirt collar. Below that, the skin was human, as was the shape. The shape of a 40-year-old man, strong and vigorous and well-made, only dwarfed to the smallness of a child. Across the hairy breast was tattooed in blue, Hengist Eversley. "Hell," said Thwaite. He stood up and went to the fatal door. Inside, he found the electric button. The room was small and lined with cases of little drawers, tier on tier rows of brass knobs on mahogany. Thwaite opened one. It was velvet-lined and grooved, like a jeweler's tray, and contained rings, the settings apparently emeralds. Thwaite dumped them into one of the empty bags he had taken from Riven's corpse. The next case was of similar drawers of rings set with rubies. The first of these Thwaite dumped in with the emeralds. But then he flew round the room, pulling out drawers and slamming them shut until he came upon trays of unset diamonds. These he emptied into a sack to the last of them. Then diamond rings on them, other jewelry set with diamonds, then rubies and emeralds, till the sack was full. He tied its neck, had me open a second sack, and was dumping drawer after drawer into that when suddenly he stopped. His nose worked hardly like that of the dead monster. I thought he was going crazy and was beginning to laugh nervously, was on the verge of hysterics when he said, "Smell." "Try what you smell," I sniffed. "I smell smoke," I said. "So do I," he agreed. "This place is a fire." "And we're locked in," I exclaimed. "Locked in?" he sneered. "Bosh." I broke open the front door the instant I was sure they were dead. "Come, drop that empty bag. This is no time for haggling." We had to step between the two corpses. Riven was horribly dead. The colors had all faded from the snout. The muzzle was all mouse color. When we had hold of the bag of coins, Thwaite turned off the electric lights and we struggled out with that and the bag of jewels and went out into the hallway full of smoke. "We can only carry these," Thwaite warned me. "We'll have to leave the rest." I shouldered the bag of coin and followed him down the steps, across a gravel road, and, oh, the relief of treading turf and feeling the fog all about me. At the wall, Thwaite turned and looked back. "No chance to try for those other bags," he said. In fact, the red glow was visible at that distance and was fast becoming a glare. I heard shouts. We got the bags over the walls and reached the car. Thwaite cranked up at once and we were off. How we went, I could not guess, nor in what direction, nor even how long. Ours was the only vehicle on the road we darted along. When the dawn light was near enough for me to see, Thwaite stopped the car. He turned to me. "Get out," he said. "What?" I asked. He shoved his pistol muzzle in my face. "You've $50,000 in bank bills in your pockets," he said. "It's a half mile down that road to a railway station. Do you understand English? Get out." I got out. The car shot forward into the morning fog and was gone. He was silent a long time. "What did you do then?" I asked. "Headed for New York," he said, "and got on a drunk. When I came round, I had barely $11,000. I headed for Cook's office and bargained for a $10,000 tour of the world. The most places in the longest time they'd give for the money, the whole cost on them. I not to need a cent after I started. What date was that? I asked. He meditated and gave me some approximate indications, rather rambling and roundabout. What did you do after you left Cook's? I asked. I put $100 in a savings bank, he said. Bought a lot of clothes and things and started. I kept pretty sober all around the world because the only way to get full was by being treated, and I had no cash to treat back with. When I landed in New York, I thought I was all right for life, but no sooner did I have my $100-and-odd in my pockets than I got full again. I don't seem to be able to keep sober. Are you sober now? I asked. Sure, he asserted. He seemed to shed his cosmopolitan vocabulary the moment he came back to everyday matters. Let's see you write what I tell you on this, I suggested, handing him a fountain pen and a torn envelope turned inside out. Word by word, after my dictation, he wrote, until you hear from me again, yours truly, no name. I took the paper from him and studied the handwriting. How long were you on that spree? I asked. Which, he twinkled. Before you came to, and had but $11,000 left, I explained. I don't know, he said. I didn't know anything I had been doing. I can tell you one thing you did, I said. What, he queried. You put 4 packets, each of $100 bills, in a thin manila class envelope, directed it to a New York lawyer, and mailed the envelope to him with no letter in it, only a half sheet of dirty paper with nothing on it except, keep this for me until I ask for it, and the signature you have just written. Honest? He enunciated incredulously. Fact, I said. Then you believe what I've told you, he exclaimed joyfully. Not a bit I don't, I asseverated. How's that? He asked. If you were drunk enough, I'd explain, to risk $40,000 in that crazy way, you were drunk enough to dream all the complicated nightmare you have spun out to me. If I did, he argued, how did I get to $50,000-odd? I'm willing to suppose you got it with no more dishonesty on your part, I told him, than if you had come by it as you described. Makes me mad you won't believe me, he said. I don't, I finished. He gloomed in silence, presently said, I can stand looking at him now, and led the way to the cage where the big blue-nosed mandrill chattered his inarticulate bestialities and scratched himself intermittently. He stared at the brute. And you don't believe me? He regretted. No, I don't, I repeated, and I'm not going to. The thing's incredible. Couldn't there be a mongrel, a hybrid? He suggested. Put that out of your head, I told him. The whole thing's incredible. Suppose she'd been a critter like this, he persisted, just at the wrong time. Bosh, I said, old wives' tales, superstition, impossibility. His head, he declared, was just like that. He shuddered. Somebody put drops in some of your drink, I suggested. Anyhow, let's talk about something else. Come and have lunch with me. Over the lunch, I asked him, what city did you like best of all you saw? Paris for mine, he grinned. Paris forever. I tell you what I advise you to do, I said. What's that? He asked, his eyes bright on mine. Let me buy you an annuity with your $40,000. I explained, an annuity payable in Paris. There's enough interest already to pay your way to Paris and leave you some cash till the first quarterly payment comes due. You wouldn't feel yourself defrauding the Eversleys, he questioned. If I'm defrauding any people, I said, I don't know who they are. How about the fire, he insisted. I'll bet you heard of it. Don't the dates agree? The dates agree, I admitted. And the servants were all dismissed. The remaining buildings and walls torn down and the place cut up and sold in portions, just about as it would have been if your story were true. There now, he ejaculated, you do believe me. I do not, I insisted. And the proof is that I'm ready to carry out my annuity plan for you. I agree, he said, and stood up from the lunch table. Where are we going now? He inquired as we left the restaurant. Just you come with me, I told him, and ask no questions. I prodded him to the Museum of Archaeology and led him circuitously to what I meant for an experiment on him. I dwelt on other subjects nearby and waited for him to see it himself. He saw. He grabbed me by the arm. "That's him," he whispered. "Not the size, but his very expression in all his pictures." He pointed to that magnificent, enigmatical, black diorite 12th Dynasty statue, which represents neither Anubis nor Seth, but some nameless cynocephalous god. "That's him," he repeated. "Look at the awful wisdom of him." I said nothing. "And you brought me here," he cried. "You meant me to see this? You do believe?" "No," I maintained. "I do not believe." After I waved a farewell to him from the pier, I never saw him again. We had an extensive correspondence 6 months later, when he wanted his annuity exchanged for a joint life annuity for himself and his bride. I arranged it for him with less difficulty than I had anticipated. His letter of thanks explaining that a French wife was so great in economy that the shrinkage in his income was more than made up for, was the last I heard from him. As he died more than a year ago, and his widow is already married, this story can do him no harm. If the Eversleys were defrauded, they will never feel it, and my conscience, at least, gives me no twinges.